Hello, this is Daniel Curzon. I'm an author, a playwright. I'm appearing on Dave Gone By, talking to Peter Fitzgerald on UNC Radio.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, everybody. This is Peter Fitzgerald, and I'm very excited. I haven't been on this radio show in months, even years. I think it's a homophobia thing. Whatever it is, I'm thrilled. Hello, everyone. And I love to talk about theater and plays and gays. And sometimes, when I'm not in a particularly good mood, I admit, my language goes a little off the charts, and I'm cursing. But I'm not cursing now. I'm Curzon, because I'm talking to a person named Curzon. Daniel Curzon. He is a novelist, an author, a playwright. His play Godot Arrives won the 1999 National New Play Contest, UGA. He just published volume 11, count them, 11 of his collected plays. We'll just talk to Mr. Curzon. He's with us. He's on the phone. Hello to you. How are you, Mr. Curzon?
I'm splendid. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm beyond splendid. I'm just thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled to be talking to you, although you have confused me. Because all week long I've been mispronouncing your name. I've been pronouncing it Curzon. And now you tell me, because it's English somehow, that it's Curzon. But what I want to know is, when I saw a little TV clip of you from about 14 years ago, they were calling you Curzon Brown. What the hell is their name?
I have many identities. I was born Danny Brown.
Uh-huh.
In Farmersville, Illinois. Couldn't be more wholesome American than that. And then when I published my first novel, Something You Do in the Dark, a heavy gay protest novel in 1971, I decided I'd better take a pen name, because back in 71, you could be fired just for being gay. So that's the reason I have a pen name. I thought it would be an elegant name, more elegant than Danny Brown. So I became Daniel Curzon. I find most Americans want to say Curzon.
That's right, yes. You know, I put my Curzon every morning. There you go. But you're Curzon the person. Now, what were you doing? Were you teaching back then in 1971? What job were you afraid of losing?
Well, actually, when the book came out, I was living in London. And I was in between teaching. But I taught for many, many years. I taught at Fresno State after that, and I taught at University of Detroit and Wayne State University in Detroit before that. I was also teaching on U.S. military bases.
Good Lord. So that was really don't ask, don't tell, in a manner of speaking.
It was before. It was don't even whatsoever.
Don't even think. So let me ask you, was there an equivalent in England, since you were there, was there an equivalent to Stonewall over there, or did things just happen more organically for gay people?
Well, I think there was not a Stonewall, per se. But when I was there, I took my book, Something You Do in the Dark, to a kind of a Stonewall meeting. It was all very clandestine and frightened, and also exciting, because something was in the air, something was going to change. But there was no riot, nothing direct like that. And as a matter of fact, I had never heard of Stonewall when I wrote my book.
Oh. You certainly were far removed from, I guess there wasn't the internet back then. You would have either had to glimpse it in the London Times, or that was about it.
Right. There was nothing then about gays, and we were so secretive, and people were constantly living in fear. When I taught on these military bases, I tried to even Xeroxing was very new then, and I was in Okinawa, in a part of Japan, and I tried to Xerox a chapter from one of my new books, and because it had some homosexual material, not even pornographic, not even close to sexual, just gay. And the education officer, the sergeant, saw it when he was Xeroxing it, because we couldn't Xerox our own stuff. And he reported me to his authorities, and then they tried to banish me from Kadena Air Base and the Marine Base, and they tried to fire me. Fortunately, I had signed my contract already for the next year. But they said I couldn't teach on those bases because I had tried to teach something gay.
Wow. And did they try and give you, like, a Section 8 and boot you out completely, or did they still want your body, as it were?
No, I was an employee, a civilian employee.
Oh. So, yes?
At the University of Maryland. I was teaching U.S. troops. I even taught in Vietnam, believe it or not.
What year? Did you teach in Vietnam?
1969.
Holy cannoli. So, wait a minute. Did you ever see any action? And I don't mean in the back room with the boys. I mean, bullet kind of action.
No, but actually, the airbase I was on, which was in Phan Rang, which is in the northern part of South Vietnam, was attacked by a plane the day I was leaving to go on Christmas break. And I have a picture of me in a flak jacket and a helmet behind a barricade of sandbags. That's my memory.
But can I ask you,
it was sort of boring.
Wait. Can I ask you, Daniel Curzon, I mean, since you were a civilian, why the hell were you going to these places?
Well, I wanted to get out of Detroit.
So let me... Vietnam, in the height of the war, was a better place to be than Detroit, Michigan.
Yes, absolutely. And Detroit wasn't that bad then.
And the sad part is it still is. That's Benghazi is a better place to be than Detroit, Michigan right now. That's the state of things.
Yeah, I haven't been back to Detroit since 1981.
Is there a reason to go back to Detroit after that? I don't know. Let me ask you, Daniel Curzon, when did you realize that you were an homosexual? I like to stress the... Well, you're English, so I'll stress the... Well, not English, but you were there for a while. So I'll stress the N before the H, the way they do, on Monty Python and Quentin Crisp. So when did you realize you were an homosexual?
Well, I realized it early on, but I didn't act on it until I was 26 years old.
Understood. Understandable.
Catholic upbringing will do that to you.
It wouldn't just be the Catholic upbringing, but if you're living on some level a clandestine and frowned upon lifestyle in society, would you meet others of your kind? It couldn't have been easy to even want or try to meet other gay men in that society, unless you were being political and really, really out. Am I right?
Yeah, it was. I just denied it, and wouldn't act on it, and finally, sex will out.
It certainly will. It certainly will. So, without naming names, how did you meet your first boyfriend?
I didn't meet my first boyfriend until many years later, when I was 39.
Wow. All right, so let's roll it back. Let's do a two-part question here. Let's divide it, as it were, kind of like a foreskin. So the first part is, how did you meet your very first sexual assignation of a gay nature?
Well. It wasn't indoors in bed, I'll say that.
Okay, that's fine. That's what it was back then. Or even now, in certain places, one assumes.
Right.
Was it a revelation for you, or did you feel dirty afterwards, or kind of both?
Oh, yeah, I felt bad. I felt
really
dirty. I mean, I was going to say I didn't even masturbate until I was 21.
Good Lord. I'm amazed their kidneys didn't explode. Oh, my goodness.
I know. And people don't believe me, but I'm telling the truth. And I was so impressed by my Catholic upbringing and the environment.
So you felt such incredible shame for being who you were, that even in your most private, with the doors shut, with the shower head going, whatever, you couldn't even bring yourself to do the do.
Well, I didn't know what it was. I mean, we were told by the nuns not to touch ourselves, so I didn't touch myself. And finally, one day, when I was 21, I touched myself, and... Oh my God, that's what they're talking about.
And you haven't stopped since. I mean, you had to make up for lost time. You were probably doing 7 times a day after that.
I must say, in my ripe old age now, I am doing quite well.
Yes, indeed. Give the man a hand. A left hand, as it were. But no, I'm teasing here. Talking with Daniel Curzon, the playwright, the openly gay author. And let me ask, were you, when you were in the denial stage, did you go out with girls? Did you try sex with them?
I went out with I had lots of dates, lots of girls invited me to dances. I was not, unpopular. I was a class president and things like that.
Good Lord!
But I just wasn't interested in sex.
Okay.
I knew that. And back in those days, you could have a date without expecting sex.
Especially if you were going to Catholic school, sure. Exactly.
So I didn't have any sex. I've had one sexual experience with a woman.
Oh.
In my life.
Was that to make the baby for the lesbian couple?
No, I don't even count that.
Oh. So that was in a cup.
It was on a military base in the masseuse, a Japanese masseuse, and she asked if I wanted a special massage for $5.
Hey, $5? Sure. You can't even get a crumbler for $5. Good Lord. I go to Starbucks, my coffee's more than that.
Well, this is 1973, probably.
Well, let me ask you, how did you feel about getting something like that from a lady person?
Oh, if you close your eyes, it's not that different.
That's what I say about pretty much everything, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my goodness. So, let me get to the nicer thing then. You mentioned when you were 39 years old, you actually had a romantic boyfriend-type relationship thing. How did that happen?
Well, I had moved to San Francisco by then, and I met this man in the back room.
All right, yes,
and,
okay.
He knew the roommate, and I sort of got infatuated with him, and we became lovers, partners for about a year and a half.
Nice.
Yeah, it was not a good relationship, I must say. It was, he was an alcoholic.
God, it seemed you sounded even ashamed of that, and there's not even a remote reason to be embarrassed or shy or ashamed about what you're just saying. So, the alcoholic part, I just feel bad for you. But what about since then? Have you had nice relationships or nice, funky, nasty ones since then?
Well, I'm with my current partner for 34 years.
Yay!
Next month, it'll be 34 years of endless bliss.
Please. You've been telling the truth since we've started talking. Don't start lying now. Please.
The only way a relationship can work for a gay man, is to have an open relationship.
Fair.
That's
you
what
see,
I've always had.
You see other people, even though you've been together for 3.5 decades, as it were.
Right.
Okay.
We don't flaunt it in each other's faces. We don't. Well,
let's rephrase that. Okay, yes. True. Now, let me ask you, though. You've been, as you said, you've been with your partner, your boyfriend, however. What is stopping you, though, if you're open about your relationship, from putting a ring on it?
Money.
What do you mean?
I don't want to mix their money.
Oh, interesting.
I live in California. We have community property.
So just in case things go wrong, and does your partner feel the same? Do you live together, even?
Yeah, we live together.
Okay.
But I don't want to have my money with his money.
Okay, and marriage would do that, in other words.
Right.
Are you thrilled, though, even though it doesn't work for you? Was it a big deal that now so many states are allowing not just civil unions, but gay, the M-word, marriage?
Yeah. What I think of it is a publicity campaign to make us more orthodox, more regular. And that's fine.
I take prunes to make me more regular. What do you mean? That was just a little comedy right there. But, okay, so you think it's more of a stunt than anything real?
Well, stunt is the word, but I would say it's part of a campaign, a publicity campaign, to defuse the situation, to make us more like normal, quote-unquote, people.
Fair enough. But you have a sort of a cynical tone to your voice when you even say that. So
I'm very cynical.
Well, why would you? Wouldn't this be the very best time in American history to be a gay man or woman?
So far, yes.
Okay. I mean, there's nothing to be cynical about. Would you rather it be 1971 again? Or you know, Anita Bryant 1980s again? It is better, isn't it?
I say in my gay etiquette book.
Oh, please, yeah, tell us about this book. What the book of gay etiquette, please.
One of the things I say that's actually on the cover is, it's in some ways, it's the best of times to be gay. It's also sometimes the worst.
Why?
The places like Uganda, Nigeria, Russia, and Mississippi.
Fair. Well, you know what? I wouldn't say that. I would say that back in 1847, it probably wasn't that wonderful to be gay in Russia then either, or Uganda, or Nigeria.
Right. I'm just saying, sometimes people don't realize that things are happening other places that are totally different from what's happening in the United States. And we're just clutching by our fingertips, as a matter of fact. I mean, if you listen to Rick Santorum and some of the other Republican yen-based from just a few years ago, they sound like Putin. Sounds like a liberal next to Rick Santorum. People like that.
Well, let me ask you, you're a playwright, you're a novelist. How on the front lines are you insofar as being at protests and marches and gay meetings and stuff like that? I mean, are you just on the sidelines writing, or do you get involved in organizations, or what?
Well, I used to be, you know, there are pictures of me and my partner, John, in the paper holding candles at various demonstrations. You know, I'm 76 years old now. It's a little harder to get out and run up and down the street with a sign.
Right. Fair enough, or trombone, considering that you're 76, yes. I don't even know what that means. Did you, by the way, when you were in San Francisco, did you know Harvey Milk?
Yeah, I met him.
Okay.
I don't know Harvey Milk, no.
All right, just curious. And let me ask again another burning issue, though certainly no pun intended, for a gay person. How did you get through, even though we're still in them, but the AIDS, HIV years of the 1980s and early 90s?
Well, one of my collaborators, Dan Turner, became sort of the spokesperson around here, around San Francisco Bay Area, for AIDS. He was one of the first diagnosed in 1981. And I figured out fairly early from his sexual practices that certain things were more likely to lead to AIDS than others. That would be anal sex.
Okay, yes.
Fortunately, I've never particularly liked anal sex.
Good to know. I'm striking that one off my list in case we ever meet. So, no for Daniel Curzon, not in the tushy. All right, that's out.
That's out.
What about nipple clamps? Are you okay with nipple clamps?
only theoretically.
Oh, dear. Oh, no nipple clamps. Nipple rouge, maybe? My goodness,
I'm very vanilla.
I see that. Well, okay, well, I make a certain vanilla pudding, but we'll talk about that later. Anywho, I don't even know what that means. I'm talking with Daniel Curzon here in the neighborhood on Dave's Gone By. This is Peter Fitzgerald doing the honors. And Mr. Curzon has written bunches of plays and also novels, too. He was talking about his first novel. And how many novels have you written since then?
I've lost track. I probably have, you know, 15.
15 novels? Oh, my goodness. And how many...
short stories.
And you have 11 volumes. Not 11 plays, but 11 volumes of plays.
Right. These are about 500 pages each.
Now, do you write every single day? Do you block out a certain period? What's your writing regimen?
I don't write every day, but I write often. I used to teach creative writing, you know, here at City College of San Francisco.
Did you say City College? City College. Or is it the same thing over there? Wiggle!
City College,
yes.
Tell students to practice what I practice, which is you have to have some passion, you have to have some anger. Something you write about that forces you to sit down at the computer or the typewriter, if you can remember what a typewriter is.
That's right.
That's how how old I am. I can remember a typewriter.
I remember electronic typewriters. My goodness, and I remember the abacus, but I'm old. But wait a minute. So you don't get writer's block?
Never.
Wow. There's always something that you feel you're ready to write about.
I want to tell somebody off. I want to get back at somebody. they have the most wonderful emotions, but I know from having had writer friends, some of them important, very famous ones, who I won't mention, they might have the same impulse. I will mention one. I knew Christopher Isherwood pretty well, and he said he knew all the tricks of modesty. I thought that was a great line. You pretend to be modest, but you're really ambitious, and you want to tell people off, and you want to... And I don't think people should be afraid of acknowledging those emotions.
Well, certainly not on paper. That's where it's the safest to do it, and yet can have the most resonance in the long term. But to tell us a little bit about Christopher Isherwood, for people who don't know, he wrote the material on which the musical Cabaret is based. He wrote the stories, what are they called? The Berlin stories, right? I Am a Camera and all that. So what was he like?
Well, he was my age when I met him. It was 40 years ago. And he praised my book, Something You Do in the Dark, at the Modern Language Association. I did not know him then.
Oh.
And someone, this is 1974, and he said he had read a wonderful book, and he would teach in a gay studies class, and I was just thrilled out of my mind. So I went up to him and said, I live in Fresno, I'm teaching at Fresno State, maybe I could come and visit you. And he was very cordial. And I went to visit him, and Don McCarty, the illustrator, the painter, and it was all wonderful. What I remember most is Isherwood was getting in the back seat of the car under a blanket when Don, his boyfriend, his much younger boyfriend, would be driving because he was terrified of the bad driving. And here I am, Danny Brown from Farmersville, Illinois, sitting in the front seat talking to a world-famous Christopher Isherwood who's hiding under a blanket.
There you go. Well, he could have been doing other things under the blanket, for all you know. Be happy he was just cowering there. If you know what I'm saying, and I think you do. Now, speaking of name-dropping, though, you do mention somewhere in your materials that, I don't know if you're friends with or you just got a good review from Joyce Carol Oates.
Yeah, we were good friends, and bad friends for 40 years.
Wait a minute. Well, what happened? Why were you good friends? How did you meet? And then, why did you fall out?
Well, we taught at the University of Detroit together. That's how we met.
Oh.
And she was not Joyce Carol Oates yet. She was just Joyce Smith in the office next door. And so I knew her before she became famous.
Wow.
But she became famous very quickly, as a matter of fact.
All it takes is one book, you know.
Yeah, her first book came out, and suddenly she was on the map, and people were fawning over her. It was sort of hard to take because I wanted to be a writer, and finally I wrote Something to Do in the Dark, and I got it published, and she did write a blurb for it. I give her credit for that. I asked her for another favor for after that, when she came to London to visit me, and she did not take that request very well, and so it ended our friendship.
And you haven't been at all in touch ever since?
Not since.
Oh, that's a shame.
I sent her an apology letter. Now, I couldn't even ask her in person, even though we just had dinner together the night before. And she was writing for the New York Times, and I thought, maybe she could ask somebody at the New York Times to write a review. And so I sent her a letter saying this, and she said, you destroyed our friendship.
Ouch. Well, do you feel guilty about it? I mean, do you feel like it was your fault, ultimately, or did she overreact?
I think she overreacted. I mean, I would never ask someone to write a review of a book that they didn't like, but she had already said she liked it. And I wasn't even asking her to write the review. I was asking her if she could get it into the hands of somebody at the New York Times that she was reviewing for them. And then what I found out later on is that the New York Times had a policy of never reviewing a gay book back then, or if reviewed, it was always a bad review.
Wow.
It was admitted by the publisher in his biography.
Who's a Punch, was it? Sulzberger?
Yes, him.
Wow.
So this is a different time when you couldn't, go around to a publicity seminar like I did when I met you.
Right.
Say, I have a gay etiquette book, and they say, oh, how wonderful.
True. See, again, it's another reason why you'd rather be a gay man now, at least in America, than any other time in probably history, as far as we know. So what are some tips from your new book? Your book, it's called The Big Book of In Your Face Gay Etiquette from Wise House Books. But was this published actually in Sweden?
Yeah, the company is in Sweden. This is actually the third edition. I did the first edition myself back in 1982. I've always been a pioneer, I like to think.
That's right. You were doing self-publishing back when nobody was, really. And now everybody is, yes.
Well, it's mostly funny things about gay things, like five things you should never say at a gay wedding.
Like?
Such as, I didn't want to come, but my wife, Edith, had already bought the toaster.
That is good.
Especially, you shouldn't say that if your wife's name isn't Edith.
Okay, very good. What's another one?
It was a lovely ceremony. Too bad both of you are going to hell for all eternity.
That's sort of a Westboro one right there. Okay, yes.
Right.
Hey, do you have any thoughts on the passing of Fred Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church? He died about a month ago.
Do I have any words?
Yeah, any thoughts on his ilk?
Good riddance.
Well, yes, okay, fair enough.
Rest in hell.
Okay. I figured that would be around what you would be saying. I was just curious. Did you ever have any run-ins with those people? Ever see them on a street corner? They're out in Texas.
I think I did see them. I've seen people like that. God Hates Fags sign in San Francisco. In various...
Well, how do you react when you see that? I mean, when I see that, I'm the type who would suddenly see red in front of my eyes and start charging at the sign. Getting myself arrested for violence. How do you pass by a sign like that and not react?
I go home and write a nasty novel. A short story.
Well, here's a question for Daniel Curzon, the writer. How do you decide when you have an idea whether it should be a short story, a novel, or a play?
Well, I think you can learn that by trial and error. There are some people who don't really have a novel-length idea. And I can't say in general, but if someone ran the idea by me, I'd say, well, how long do you think people want to read about that? Do they want to read about that for 400 pages or maybe 3 pages? Some people have a better instinct for that than others.
That's fair. And let me ask you, what's your process as far as, let's say you've got the first draft done of a novel? How many drafts further do you do? How much revising, editing? Are you more of a writer person or a rewriter person?
I'm pretty much of a writer person by now. In fact, most of the time. I wouldn't say I don't rewrite. It sounds egotistical and awful. But I don't have to rewrite and polish because it pretty much comes out where I want it the first time, with some changes here and there and so on. But that's from long years of doing it, too.
That's true. Now, you told us about your first novel. What was your first play?
Oh, my first play actually was never produced.
Okay.
The one I think a friend of yours in New York was 1987. It was called My Unknown Son.
Oh, so that was your very first play that was produced, was My Unknown Son. In the 1980s, we know that play because Dave Lefkowitz, who is the host and producer of this radio program and who is kind enough to let me on here once in a very blue moon, that was one of the very, very first plays he ever reviewed as a theater critic, one of his first published reviews, which he gave a fairly positive review to, as I recall. Not that I was there at the time, but he told me about it. He's like, it was a very a strange sort of mix of Sam Shepard and other kind. What was? Tell us a little about this play.
Well, it's based on the fact that I have sired or fathered a child with a lesbian couple in real life.
Sounds like fun. Yes. Okay.
I had not seen him in person. He's my biological child, but it was done through less traditional methods of conception, shall we say.
So who held the turkey baster?
It was an eyedropper.
It was an eyedropper. I figured it was an eyedropper. Yes, wow.
The midwife. The midwife held the eyedropper.
Oh.
After I donated my artichoke jar. My son, who's now almost 31, has a tattoo of an artichoke on the back of behind his neck, because it's a tribute to how he was conceived.
Now, wait a minute. So have you met him ever, or are you?
Yeah. At the time of this play, my unknown son, I had not met him. It's complicated, but I won't go into it.
Okay, sure.
They had a second child. They didn't want that child to not have a father because there were two different fathers involved.
I imagined
what my son might turn out to be, and I did it as though the playwright, a father, is writing a book on the history of the theater. And so he imagines these different sons. One of them is Greek tragedy. One of them is, you know, the idea behind that is, what if you had a son who hated you and wanted to kill you because of the way he was made? And the next one would be, what if you had a fool, like in a Shakespeare play? In other words, what if you had a retarded child? How would you react to that? And so on, through different styles, up to Sam Shepard, where you have this homophobic, drunken father. So it's all the different styles of theater.
That sounds amazingly clever. It sounds like a lot of fun, really. To have so many different styles in the play, yeah. And you got it done off-Broadway, which is, for a first play, that's pretty wonderful. That's amazing.
Yeah, it got to New York off-Broadway because it had a spectacular staged reading in Marin. Marin is across the bridge, the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge. And it was seen by a director from a theater in New York. And he loved it. I've never had or before such a positive reaction to the play. And it was taken then to New York, to the Circle and the Square, I think it was, in 87, and it was seen by
The downtown one, that's right, yes.
Right. It was seen by a producer who had his own theater, the Kaufman Theater on 42nd Street. And he picked it up, and then a year later it was produced off-Broadway. Unfortunately,
wow.
That production wasn't as good as the one in Marin County. And people don't seem to understand that the way the play is done, who does the play, makes a tremendous difference, especially when it's a new script.
Oh, of course.
And
I mean,
I would say, you know, people don't believe that, so you're just making an excuse. But you know, I've seen umpteen high school productions of Shakespeare plays. If those were the first productions of Shakespeare,
that's right. It
couldn't be Shakespeare.
Well, have there been other productions of My Unknown Son that you've seen that were more to your liking, that were better?
Yeah, it was done a few years later in Los Angeles.
Ah.
And I went down to see that, and it was a very good production. Unfortunately, two of the three cast members walked out for other reasons.
Welcome to the world of the theater.
It's the world of the theaters, right?
Now, let me ask you, Daniel Curzon. Out of all the plays that you have written, all 11 volumes worth, and you're saying they're roughly 500 pages each, so we're talking about 1,500 pages of play script. Is there one play that is closest to your heart that you feel is either your best work or, if not your best, then your most representative and most personal and successful in that way?
Well, I'm closest to the one I just wrote, which is called The Importance of Being Cecily or Cecil. And it's a takeoff. It's an alternate reality play. The importance of being earnest. In my play, all the characters basically are gay, and which is probably what was...
Not so different from Oscar Wilde, really, but okay, yes.
But because it's not overt in Oscar Wilde, it couldn't be. It's hinted at. It's,
sure.
It's one of the reasons he went to jail. But, so, I thought it was immensely fun to write. You also have to have a lot of energy to get out and get your play produced. It just doesn't happen. If people are playwrights, they think, well, writing the play is hard. But no, the hard part is getting it put on with competent actors, with a good director.
Do you have an agent?
I don't have an agent at the moment. I never had an agent for my plays.
Oh, wow. So that does make it difficult. You have to submit and you have to know artistic directors and producers and things like that and just be out there constantly. That is a grind. Am I right?
Most people don't have that ability, to be honest. They don't have, you have to have enormous drive. You can't just, if it happens and you sit back and people come running to you, it happens to one in a million writers.
Exactly.
Mostly, you have to go out and you have to pitch it and you have to promote it and you have to enter contests and on and on and on. And then maybe, because you're lucky, people say, don't I know you? Haven't I heard of you?
Isn't that the greatest thing for a writer? When you're not well-known and you're not rich, it's like, oh, I think I saw something of yours once. Not even that I loved it, but just that they think they vaguely know you.
It's wonderful.
That's the great reward of being a writer. Are you also, do you still teach?
No, I retired 7 years ago.
Okay, so do you write more now that you are no longer teaching, or do you fill up your time with other things?
I write about the same amount. I mean, I chose to get a PhD in part because I knew I would have a good schedule, which would allow me time to write. It sounds vain, but I mean, I made a choice when I was 18 to go. I come from uneducated people, I should point out. My mother went to the fourth grade in Tennessee. They were not pushy about education. They didn't even want me to go to college. But I could see the only way out of my background was to get all the degrees I could. And I also realized, you know, that college teachers have a lot of time off. Don't tell anybody.
But that time off, they're usually having to write books or articles or get published or something like that, which you were.
I was, right? I did scholarly articles for years before I started writing fiction and plays. So I did all the right things. That I found myself, you know, with a PhD in umpteen publications as a part-timer in 1980. And I was very angry. I couldn't get, you know, into the next phase, which was full-time. I had been full-time before. Because they were keeping us part-timers enslaved. I'm still angry about it. And it took a lawsuit to get 22 of us in the English department at City College of San Francisco to get full-time and tenure jobs. It changed my life tremendously in 1988.
Well, you have tried to use the law a few times to switch things. Amazingly enough, nothing to do with your sexuality or anything like that, but mostly with school. And I have to say, I'm a little surprised that you're on the other end of laws. Forgive the using the word end in this context. But the lawsuit that you had involving school and a kid, literally like a teenager, who put up a website about a decade and a half ago about rating teachers, rating professors at high schools and colleges and such. And you had an issue with that. Why don't you explain?
Yes, that's when I was on the Today Show with Matt Lauer.
Yes.
Because it was cyberbullying of teachers. We didn't call it cyberbullying then. And I warned at that time that it was wrong to have a website where anyone could go on and review a teacher, even if they had not been a student of the teacher, which was true in my case because I saw this for all the potential that has now become, that you could get on there and defame people, say obscene things about them without consequence. And it could be an ex-boyfriend, it could be your ex-wife, it could be a colleague in the English department who doesn't like you for some inside reason. didn't have to be. And so people could go on anonymously and write six reviews of you saying you're a terrible teacher and you're a horrible person, and no one reading it would know whether it was true or not. But they'd say, well, I better avoid that person. And if you didn't get 20 students in the class was canceled.
Well, that was the one way that it could affect you. I mean, because people will, students incoming to the college or into the next semester could read this website or others like it and go, oh, well, this guy got 4 out of 7 reviews that are terrible. I guess I'll take the other course with the other professor. So in that way, it can affect you. I see that. But don't you see the positive side of a free society of people being able to comment rather uncontrolled and then let the user try to figure out what's real and what isn't?
No.
Well, I mean, the idea has continued.
I think it's okay for people to review corporations, big entities. They can't really be hurt.
Now, wait a minute. Let's say someone goes and to a McDonald's website or their Facebook page and say, I found a human thumb in my McMuffin.
Well, then they better bring a lawsuit and find out if it's true.
Well, there you go. Well, isn't it if it's not libelous and it's not slanderous and it's just opinion, even if it's fake opinion, as it were, I mean, that's just a consequence of freedom, isn't it?
Yeah, but it doesn't matter to McDonald's because no one's going to stop the business of McDonald's by some individual post. Whereas with an individual teacher, it's much more personal and harmful. So I make a distinction. I mean, I'm a gay writer, as we've indicated. I know the problem of getting free speech. I'm not against free speech, but I am against people writing things that are lies.
But if they're writing lies, then shouldn't the lawsuit be trying to find the person who wrote the lie rather than the person who provides a bulletin board format for everyone to comment and tell lies and or truth? You wanted to throw all the blame on the person who founded the website.
Well, because he didn't run the website the way it should be run. And now, as I said, other people are finding out that they can be cyberbullied and harassed. And it's not going to change until the federal law, which protects the Internet, is changed. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996 gives special privilege to the Internet to help along. Well, it's done quite well. It doesn't need any more help. You cannot go on a radio program and defame somebody. You can't write a letter to the editor anonymously and defame somebody, even a teacher. They wouldn't publish it.
However, if you go on YouTube and you want to say horrible, racist, nasty things about whoever's in the video, you can. I mean, you can't do it on yours because you blocked any kind of commentary, but on most, if Pharrell does a music video and somebody hates Pharrell, they can say the most abominable things, and that's just part of the freedom there.
No, I think it should be monitored the way a newspaper is.
I don't know. I'm very, very mixed feelings about this because any kind of, as you, as a writer and artist would know, any kind of border on free speech can then be taken back and back and back and back. You don't want to go down a slippery slope. Well, and you don't like anal, so you don't like going down slippery slopes anyway. Ooga! Wiggle! We're talking with Daniel Curzon here on Dave's Gone By, wrapping up our conversation with the playwright, the novelist, the author. Now, you also have a novel out that is not a gay thing or a teacher thing. It's called Halfway to the Stars, Cable Car Tales of a Grumpy Gripman. What on earth? What is that?
That's the other side of me.
Okay. The side we don't see in anal, yes?
It's a bisexual narrator. I pretend to be a cable car driver. Actually, a friend of mine was a cable car driver.
Uh-huh.
But I live in San Francisco, and I've driven on the cable cars. And I think every time people see me and they're from someplace, I say, oh, what a wonderful city San Francisco is. And it is. And anyway, it's also a nightmare downtown. And a lot of people don't realize how many crazy people, homeless people, there are downtown around the cable cars. And so I imagine the cable car driver giving you a slice of his life on a daily basis. And he's not pleased with what he sees, and he says very politically incorrect things. If you want free speech, I'll give it to you.
That actually sounds like fun. But since you cloak your stuff in fiction, you can... I mean, let's say you were writing an actual Romano Clef. You were the cable car gripman, and you started telling all these tales about the homeless people and the crazy people. I guess if they're true, that's okay. Yes?
I don't... They're made up names. They're not
right,
made
yeah.
kind of real characters, but I don't use their real names.
Now, are most of your books, the collections of plays... The gay etiquette book, the cable car book, are they available through all the usual sources like Amazon? Yes?
Yes, they're both available on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Nookbooks.
Nookbooks, that's new. And what about from your website? Can people go to your website and buy stuff there?
I have a thing set up. I'm not sure if it works.
Okay.
No one's ever used it.
Oh, well, but you can find out about all your works and what you're doing.
Spell my name, I suppose.
Yes.
The last name is spelled CURZON. DanielCurzon.com is my website.
DanielCurzon.com, yes.
Right. I have pictures of my books and reviews and so on. More than you can possibly stand.
Well, yeah, I mentioned that you also do some cartoons. Are those yours towards the end of the site?
Yeah, Cat Talk.
Cat Talk, yes, cat cartoons. So cat lovers, even though very few people listening to this particular interview will like pussy, if you like cats, this is the place to go. Wow, you didn't laugh at that. Oh, well.
Or if you dislike cats.
That's fair enough. If you dislike cats, although I do love cats as delicatessen. Yum, yum. We're finishing up our conversation with Daniel Curzon. I guess you made enough money, you saved enough money from finally being a full-time teacher that you can now live comfortably just on your writing. Is that true?
Man, I've never been able to live on my writing, but I have a nice pension from teaching college for 46 years.
46? Oh, my goodness, yes. Yeah, and even in a place like San Francisco, which is extremely expensive, you're okay.
Yeah, I bought a condo in 1988 on a credit card. And it's the best thing I ever did in my life.
Very, very smart. Do you travel much?
I do, yeah. I usually spend 5 weeks in England every summer.
Oh, very nice. And how often do you get to go see, like, your plays being produced in other places?
Not as often as I'd like.
Fair enough.
But it happens from time to time. I've actually had some productions I didn't go see. And so that's interesting. That's when I think you've really arrived.
That's right. When suddenly you get a note that, well, we're doing your play in Italy. We'd love to invite you, but we don't have that kind of a budget. But we're doing it. And that's okay.
Yeah, my play, The Cadeau Arise, which won the National New Play Contest, was done in India twice. It was done in Gannon University in Pennsylvania. It was done in Edinburgh Fringe Festival. I didn't see all those productions, but I got pictures from the people who did that.
Well, that's all right. I mean, again, even more than the pittance of a royalty you would get, it's just the idea, oh, someone's hearing my word. I am conveying something to a few people in an audience somewhere, and that's what it's all about.
Validation.
Indeed. And, oh, which reminds me, I have to validate my parking. Uh-oh. Well, that's as good a time as any to thank so much our guest in the neighborhood, Daniel Curzon. Remember, it's CURZON. DanielCurzon.com is the place to go for plays like Meter Maids and Flames, 1001 Nights at the House of Pancakes, A History of Really, Really Bad Ideas. I love that title. And The Noisy Nun. Last question for you, Daniel. Does the title come first? Does the play come first? What comes first? And I don't mean during masturbation either.
I like the title Meter Maids and Flames, and I sort of wrote a play to go with it.
Okay, fine. But sometimes it'll be the play, and then the play will suggest the title. It just depends on what you're working on.
More often than not, it's the idea that comes first, and then the title. I would change titles.
During the process of writing the play, you'll change.
Right, or afterwards.
That makes complete sense. Well, I titled this interview a smashing success, and just has been a delight talking with Daniel Curzon. I only wish you much more health, much, much more writing. See, now that you're not teaching anymore, you should take all these extra hours and write 47 volumes of plays.
I'm writing as we speak.
Boy, oh boy. Even as we speak.
I just finished the play.
Talk about multitasking. Oh, what's it called? What's it called?
Talking with Peter Fitzgerald. Oh. The delight of all time.
I assume it's a tragedy. Oh, well.
Could be.
Well, Daniel, it's been great, great fun. Thank you so much for appearing with us in the neighborhood.
Thank you for asking me.
Bye-bye now.